Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by Dr. Ellen Miller, who is the CBT Program Director, who oversees the training and clinical services at the Beck Institute. As a clinician, Ellen has used CBT to help people of all ages with a myriad of presenting problems coming from forensic, community, educational, and medical settings. He has conducted workshops, written professional articles, and published several resource books for lay readers about personality, depression, anxiety, and stress. Ellen was also well acquainted with the late Dr. Aaron Beck, the founder of CBT, having first attended Dr. Beck's class at the Beck Institute in 1994, an experience he described in another interview as having filled him with awe and dread, and one that would prove to be the start of a very long friendship. Welcome to the show, Ellen. How are you?
Oh, thank you very much. I'm really honored to be asked to be a part of your show today.
You've met Dr. Beck in 1994. I met you in 2022 when I attended your workshop on supervision. And I think I was also filled with the same feelings of awe and dread with your mastery of CBT. So I was wondering, what was it like to develop a relationship with Dr. Beck? I think right now he's this really sort of large, almost mythical figure, and with, you know, many sort of stories passed down. And I don't know now what is true, but, you know, you've had many encounters with the man himself. What was that like?
You know, initially, I did have awe and fear, because although it was a number of years ago, he had already established himself. And you have to think about what kind of person it is that we're talking about. This was a person who was a scientist in the truest sense of the word. And he is somebody who bucked the system and had tremendous personal strength to carry on with his research and his ideas, despite being rejected by the psychoanalytic system that he was a part of for so many years. And so just his personal strength and character was something to be admired and just respected from the very beginning. So I think that some of the ideas that we bring to those kinds of encounters contributes to the kind of fear and difficulty that we have, because getting to know him over time as a person, as a human being, then you learn very different things about him. He was perhaps the most curious person I've ever met. He wanted to know everything about everything and whatever you were working on. Probably his first question when he would start talking with somebody, anybody, was, so what have you been working on? Tell me about it. And he would pursue that. And he would do that in the most supportive way. And being both congratulatory and at the same time offering his own ideas and thoughts. He had a great sense of humor. And he was a very kind human being. And so this is one of the things that is kind of the part of him that isn't well known or well talked about, I think, and that is that he's well known as a scientist and he's well known for developing techniques. And this science aspect of it, now this is my own interpretation. I can't say that I've read this anyplace, but my own interpretation of him and what he did was that for him, science was a means to an end. And I can only say that because after I came to know him for a number of years, what he really cared about was helping people and helping people to have a better life. And science was a way to develop methods and to confirm methods that would be most helpful to people. He didn't want to just throw things without any kind of research or evidence to support their efficacy or effectiveness. So his main concern was to help people, and science was the way to figure out what are going to be the things that are going to be most helpful to people. And then another part of CBT is the structure that we use. And this is the delivery of how we provide CBT to people. So you asked about my relationship with him. So initially in awe, but I came to, I think, respect him more as a human being than I did as a scientist because of his curiousness, because of his kindness, because of his humanism. And I think that those are things that have not been talked about so much within even the CBT field about him. So in his latter years, I would just look forward to the opportunity to sit and have lunch with him at Beck Institute and just talk about what he's working on and what other people at the table are working on.
That's really interesting. And I've met, you know, many therapists, and some are really well-known therapists, well-known for teaching and training a therapy that's meant to be very empathic, or, you know, really good with emphasizing alliance. And when you meet them, they're not that warm in person. And so what I've realized is, like, therapists could be really good therapists. Even Harry Stack Sullivan was not very warm in person. And your book's written about that. So you could be a therapist that's a really good therapist, very good at connecting with clients, but not great with connecting to just other people in your life. You know, and it sounds like Aaron Beck, you know, was very good at that. You know, he was very warm, he was very curious, he was attentive.
Ordinary. And he was like that with everybody, not just in a work setting, but his children, his grandchildren would talk about him. And whatever they wanted to talk with him, he had all the time in the world for them. And he had the same level of curiosity. He had the same level of support. He had the same level of interest in them as they did with anybody. So, you know, sometimes I sort of sarcastically say that, you know, those of us in the business, we're nice to people when we're being paid for it, but when we're off the clock, we're, you know, we're just ourselves.
I mean, my capacity for empathy is not, you know,
there are limits to it, but for him, I don't know. Certainly he had his moments where he was short and he was down to business and he wanted things to be done, but underneath it all, he was a very kind human being. And that, I think, is what I come to respect more about him than being a scientist. Not that being a scientist is not important, but.
So you've got this really, I mean, he's a scientist, and you really emphasize how he wanted to help people by using science, but that he was such a caring human being, and he really cared about the well-being of each person, but the lives of each person, and regardless of who you are and your status. And then how do you think CBT then evolved to have a reputation of being mechanistic, manualized, you know, just delivered by reading off the book, which is doesn't sound anything like who Aaron Beck was, or, you know, how CBT was meant to be.
Yeah. And that's right. Aaron Beck and his daughter Judith Beck did not ever do manualized therapy. And we don't do manualized therapy. But to your question, how did this happen that CBT came to be recognized as a technique, mechanistic kind of thing, when that isn't who he was? And I think there are forces within the CBT community that contributed to that. But I think that there are forces from the outside world that contributed to that as well. From the CBT community, one of the things certainly within among psychotherapists in the world, there was a need to demonstrate that what we did was effective. And during the years in the 1960s, we're coming out of an era that was very strongly dominated by psychoanalysis, and then behavior therapy had its run at it. And within behavior therapy, there was a good deal of research demonstrating the effectiveness of techniques that were developed. Dr. Beck came in kind of after behavior therapy had already had its start. Now, Albert Ellis had done some work and had done some writing on rational emotive therapy, which is out of the cognitive model, of course, based on cognitive theory. But what Beck did from the very beginning was to integrate some of the humanness, the cognitive aspect of things, and the behavioral aspect of things. And in fact, in one of his first books, Cognitive Therapy of Depression, which was published in 1979, I think, there was a whole chapter on the therapeutic relationship. So he always had a strong emphasis on that. But there was a need in psychotherapy to demonstrate its effectiveness when compared to other forms of therapy. But we were also, at the time, I think, in greater competition with the medical community and with medicines about, you know, pharmaceutical companies doing their research to say, our medicine works, this is all that you need. And I'm not saying that that's anybody's position today, just talking about historically, I think that this is the way that it came about. And I think that there became a very strong emphasis for the cognitive behavior field to want to demonstrate its efficacy and effectiveness. And I think that that's what the consumers in the world wanted to know. Does this work? You know, you're telling me to come in and sit down and talk to you, and you're telling me that that's going to make a difference in my life. I want to take a pill and I want to feel better, you know? So we had to demonstrate our efficacy. And so I think that that's what people zeroed in on, out of a sense of necessity to some extent. And then there's another aspect to it, that what has happened over the decades is that there has been a greater influence for getting immediate gratification from doing things. And so people want to narrow things down to its single most element. So I can do this, and this is going to make this change, and we're going to get the best bang for our buck out of this. And what gets lost in that is the importance of the therapeutic relationship, the importance of conceptualizing what is going to be best for each individual. And so, again, to answer your question, I think it's a combination of the CBT community wanting to demonstrate its worth and its value, and the world kind of demanding that we do that. And when you're looking at numbers and outcome studies, you don't get a feel for the therapeutic relationship that was established in order to get those kinds of outcomes.
So one thing, I mean, just for our listeners, so manualized therapy often refers to, you know, a manual is written telling you what to do for every session. You know, session one, this is what you do. Session two, this is what you do. Session three. And so that, you know, it provides some consistency, especially when you're testing out a new therapy. You want to run clinical trials. And that was what Alan's referring to as well. You know, the competition with the medical model, and why 12 sessions? Well, because, you know, the pharmaceutical companies were doing 12 sessions. And so it was kind of matching that time frame. There's nothing also magical about 12 sessions. So yeah, you're right. You know, this perhaps what is done in research for a certain purpose versus what needs to be done to in every session to help people. And the people, by the way, doing therapy for the studies, they are supervised almost every session to make sure that they are hearing to the therapy. They're not just kind of like unleashed loose and kind of just do whatever you think it is. So it's actually done very properly. And so possibly, you know, when we think manualized therapy, we're also not seeing how these individuals have been trained to connect with their clients. And I think one thing you talked about was the meta-analysis that you said that people who say they're practicing CBT are perhaps not having the outcomes. And could you tell us a little bit more about that?
We see this a lot. And even to take it to the extreme, in the United States, for instance, being in the psychotherapeutic business, if you will, it's very competitive. And CBT is a commonly recognized form of therapy. And people know that it is research-based and that it is many times going to produce positive outcomes. So we know people who will have on their website, we do CBT therapy. And when you talk to them, we've had people say, no, I don't really do CBT. I just put that there so that I can get the business. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I'm telling you what people have told us. No, I don't really do that. And then other people will say, well, yes, I use a technique here and there. And so therefore, I incorporate CBT into everything else that I do. So I put CBT there so that people know that I use CBT and that will be attractive and that will be sellable. And when people pick and choose a technique here and there, and incorporated into otherwise the way that they do things, it isn't surprising that one would not get the same results. I mean, if you think about taking an antibiotic, depending on which one, a regimen of antibiotics might be to take the antibiotic for 10 days. Well, if somebody says, well, yeah, I prescribe antibiotics, but I only tell my people to take it for 3 days. Well, are you going to get the same outcome if you take it for 3 days? You're still using the same medicine, but if you only take it for 3 days as opposed to 10 days, you're not going to get the same result. And with CBT, if you just pick and choose techniques here and there, I would say that it's not likely that you're going to get the same results that Aaron Beck got, because Aaron Beck didn't pick and choose. He formed a therapeutic relationship. He conducted conceptualizations, and then he applied techniques based upon the needs of the individual. And that's why he got the kind of results that he got. And at Beck Institute, that's what we're promoting and that's what we're supporting. More so the process of delivering cognitive behavior therapy. We don't take issue with anybody that has research to support a technique, whether it's particular to a cognitive model or whether it's a behavioral model or DBT or ACT or whatever. There is research to support all of those, and we have no argument with any of that. In fact, I incorporate evidence-based techniques from other models into the way that we, into the treatment that we provide in order to provide the most individualized, most appropriate care for each person. And the difference is the process by which we deliver it, because we emphasize the importance of the therapeutic relationship and the developing of the treatment plan and the conceptualization and individualizing it throughout the entire process.
Which seems so different from, I think, how many people have been taught CBT. So I often say this, I give this example. So I trained about 10 years ago. I started training in CBT 10 years ago, and we were taught, when we asked, you know, how are you feeling? And somebody said, well, I feel that he really snubbed me, and which is a thought. We were then supposed to correct that client and said, that's a thought. That's not a feeling. You know, here's the feeling wheel. Understand the feelings. I mean, it was quite fierce. You know, if you think about it, we were like sort of coming in as the expert of what feelings were and what thoughts were. And we're gonna really educate the client. And the way you're talking about it, that relationship first, I think that was really missing from, you know, at least my earlier training of what CBT was. So I really appreciate you sort of emphasizing that. And I think for listeners, who may be confused and said, is this a new development or was it always there?
And it was always there. You know, back when Beck Institute opened in 1994. Now, I was already a trained psychologist. I'd already had training in behavior therapy, but I was in the first class at Beck Institute in 1994. And even then, I can remember Judy Beck, Aaron Beck's daughter, saying, you know, what you need to do if you haven't already done this is read Carl Rogers and learn how to develop a relationship the way that Carl Rogers did. Now, it wasn't specifically incorporated into our training, but we were told you need to be able to do this before you do all this other stuff. And there was some level of assumption. Now, coincidentally or not, I also had already been trained by some people who were trained by Carl Rogers. And so I had some knowledge of that and a great appreciation for that. And in fact, that was one of the things that appealed most to me about the Beck model, as opposed to some of the other models that exist under the CBT umbrella, and that is the humanistic aspect of it. That was something that was a part of my early training that has always been very important to me. And so hearing that, you need to read Carl Rogers. And in many ways, you know, the client-centered approach is very consistent with the Socratic model or the Socratic approach to things, because within the cognitive model, we use Socratic questioning in order to help a person to achieve a new view, a cognitive shift, and to come up with their own conclusions about what is the right thing for them. So our purpose is not to be able to demonstrate that we can make people change to be the way that we think that they should be or that they would be better off, but to help them to decide what is the best way for them to be and then to use the techniques to help them to achieve that.
This is spontaneous, but, you know, and I know we don't have a lot of time yet, but I kind of put you on the spot and say, could you give me maybe a 5-minute demonstration of Socratic questioning? Because, you know, I've heard various iterations of it. Sometimes it's like, you know, almost interrogating the other person. You know, what do you think this means? You know, whatever. So I was wondering, you know, for our listeners, especially as we're talking about maybe what CBT was meant to be and should be, and that's why it's effective, could you just give us a short demonstration? I'll be the client. And just, yeah, how do you do Socratic questioning in a collaborative way would be, I think, of great interest to our listeners.
Okay, sure. So give me something. Be your client, say something, and I'll pick up from there.
So first we'll ask, does it have to be a negative event or like a negative thought?
I don't put rules on it. You say whatever you want, and then the burden is on me to come up with the Socratic questions.
And that's what I actually really love about CBT, the flexibility of it. So I would say, you know, I recently had a conversation with someone from a corporation, and it just left me feeling really dumb. I just felt bad after. Maybe I wanted the conversation to go a different way. And it affected my mood. I actually felt not great after that conversation.
So after you had this conversation with the person, you were thinking that you could have done better, and because you didn't live up to your own expectation, you were feeling pretty down about that, and down about yourself and about your skills. So what is it that you think that if you were to do that again, what might you have done differently?
I don't know. I wasn't sure whether, like, because I was fairly open with that person. I was thinking maybe I shouldn't be so open, you know, maybe I should have been more guarded. I don't know. You know, maybe not so vulnerable, basically.
So you're kind of second guessing yourself that I should have done, maybe I shouldn't have done some of the things I did. And I did do things that I shouldn't have done. So let me ask this. Has there ever been a time or an experience in your life where you've had a similar kind of experience, where you've gone into something and then kind of second-guessed yourself afterwards?
Yeah, I guess I always second guess myself if the conversation doesn't leave me with a good feeling of okay. I was like, oh yes, you know, I liked that person and the person liked me, into some sort of reciprocal liking.
So you always second guess yourself. So I'm wondering, do you go into those kinds of encounters with certain expectations of yourself?
Not consciously, I'll admit. I give the expectation, you know, suck, just be yourself, you know, just be natural. But I guess maybe my expectation is greater than just be authentic. You know, maybe I do have higher expectations of that. Or
so, yeah. If we had more time in our session today, I would maybe go a different direction, but let me ask you a couple of things first. So as a result of the experience that you had, and what do you think is the worst thing that's going to happen as a result of that?
Maybe it's a missed opportunity, okay. You know, for collaboration. Okay. Yeah.
A missed opportunity, didn't do things as well as you might have. Do you think would be the best possible outcome from that?
The best would be I'll be offered a job straight away. The person would be like so impressed with me. I was like, so curious. You're amazing. Like, come
just
on board
knock
now.
Their socks off. You're just blown away.
Right, blown away.
What do you think is the most likely thing that's going to happen?
Probably nothing bad or good, because it was a single encounter. To be honest, I don't know that person. And I think, yes, other opportunities would come up. Okay. Would be the most likely. Yeah.
Do you expect that you will have other such encounters in your future?
I think so.
Okay.
They do happen. Yeah.
And do you have an idea about what it is that you would do, or how you would like to come across, and how you would like that to go?
As I'm talking to you, I realize that my idea is of this ideal self that is impossible. Apparently, I think I'm supposed to be charming and witty and super intelligent and you know, so interpersonally skilled and jiving with it. Probably just impossible, impossibly high.
And so although you said a moment ago that you weren't really intentionally or aware that you're going in with expectations of yourself, it sounds like you do have sort of an expectation of what this should look like, how this should go.
And apparently, I'm talking to you more, I realize that it's very unrealistic, I think, okay. High expectations.
Well, what do you think would be perhaps a realistic expectation?
I think honestly, sometimes conversations will go well if there's interest and connection, and you know, there's a common, maybe common interest with that. And that is not only me, you know. I think I realize that maybe the conversations that do go well, it's not just one way. The other person is also showing interest. The other person is also engaged with me. And then I feel, yeah, like, okay, that's something good. And I guess it's not because I'm super witty and amazingly charming and everything else. Yeah.
And so one really important component of conversations that go well is that it's a two-way street, and that it's a mutually shared responsibility, and that you alone are not responsible for and probably cannot make it be the perfect encounter if the other person isn't participating.
Yeah, that's fair to say. I think that that's probably it. So I think, though, you give me your last line, and then I think we have to wrap this up.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you would indulge me. We'll just do it for 10 seconds. Would you, with taking a realistic view, imagine yourself in an encounter of the kind that you would like to have, and where things go really well?
Okay. Yep.
What is the feeling that you get while you're imagining that?
Happiness.
Great. So is happiness something that you would like to have happen, experiencing happiness when you have your next encounter and other future encounters?
Yeah.
What would you see as the first step that you could take in order to help that to come about in the future?
Accepting that it's not just my responsibility and just kind of like being less hard on myself, okay. You know, and kind of just taking like each encounter and just noticing either whether the person themselves, you know, the other person, whether they want to be in it as well, rather than just everything rests on me.
So that's terrific. And I'll just summarize very briefly. So it sounds like you've made a bit of a cognitive shift in terms of the expectations that you have of yourself going into it, even though you weren't initially even aware of some of the expectations that you've had. You've made a change that you're realistic and recognize that it isn't all your responsibility and that there are actual steps that you can take going forward. I'll stop there. That's the end. So I integrated a number of different things there. Certainly there were some Socratic questions included. There was some imagery included. There was some directing things in a direction in the future. But what I tried to avoid doing at any time is telling you what to do or what you shouldn't do. It was to help you to think your way through it. And that was the purpose and the technique of using the Socratic questions with a slight peppering of other things in there with it.
Really, thanks, Alan. One thing I think I really liked was that very much more, first of all, like very reflective, you know, and that you really taking interest in my problem, although, you know, that you weren't expecting me to thrush you in this role. But, you know, there was something, I think there was a real interest in me and I can see, you know, really make sense, the emphasis of on the relationship first, rather than, you know, do this, do that. And I've got a solution for you. You know, why don't you try that? And I think next time don't be hard on yourself. Right. So the last thing I want to ask, and I want to wrap this up, is how can someone then train to be a good CBT therapist? And I know this is slightly leading. I'm not paid by Beck Institute, Ellen is, but I will happily, I think, advertise this because, you know, as I mentioned, just being introduced to CBT more than 10 years ago, I think the training that I received there really challenged my own model of CBT, and I think made it a lot more collaborative. And one thing that you talked about and alluded to was that maybe people are rushing to just deliver, you know, like a technique and said, okay, this should work and that should work and this should work. And I've seen that with trainees as well. Like, okay, how am I going to be a good therapist? If it's just technique, you know, just let me memorize the manual and then I'll be there. And then it might be disappointing, I guess, for people to know that CBT is so humanistic, as you said, and very relational.
It is very much so. One of the things that I say in a lot of the workshops that I do when people ask questions about this is, first of all, remind them, and Judy is very says this very often, and that is that learning to do CBT well is a lifelong learning process. That I'm a better therapist than I was 5 years ago, and I hope 5 years from now I'm a better therapist than I am now. So it isn't a place that we arrive at. And so we shouldn't place that expectation on ourselves that there's a place that I'm going to arrive at and then I'm done. That it's a continuous process, continuous work. And related to that is, you don't have to know everything. You don't have to know the answers to things. What we have to do is care about people. We have to be curious. We have to demonstrate our interest. And from a skill perspective, something that is really helpful is if we can learn to ask good questions to help people to draw their own conclusions and decide for them what is best. The technique part of it, we want to have a certain level of technique ability, but we need to remember that we're not working with machines, that we're working with human beings. And our goal in working with human beings is to help them to have a better experience in life as a human being. And if a technique can help us to do that, that's fine. But ultimately, it's about the client and helping the client to achieve what it is that they want to do. If I take advantage of the question, what can people do? Beck Institute offers tremendous courses in training. And if you go to beckinstitute.org, we have all kinds of courses that are there. And we have a new course coming out that I was very involved in, which actually covers a lot of the things that we were just talking about today.
I would also highly recommend, I'm happy to recommend the courses at Beck Institute. There's some on-demand ones so that, you know, you don't have to stay up late. I was bugging Alan about offering more courses in Asia. But, you know, for now, yeah, that's what we have. And if you're looking for how do you improve your CBT skills and learn how to actually do CBT, I think the right way, which isn't about techniques, but more and more connection, which is what psychotherapy is about. Please head over to beckinstitute.org. So a great thanks to you, Alan, for joining us on this podcast and sharing your wisdom.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me to be here. Great talking to you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Being Human. We'll be hosting guests on a regular basis, so be sure to tune in for some more insights on how we can understand ourselves better and learn to live a life on our own terms and one that's meaningful to us. My name is Dr. Chuasa Kning, and I look forward to sharing some more valuable insights from the world of mental health with you very soon.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.